Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake McClure. Well, I will talk about such exciting things as mercantile exchanges and cryptocurrency collapse. Things that, to some people, are the definition of boring, hopefully will be slightly fun, at the very least, during this episode. All right, so what is this episode? I just told you it was the personal wealth coach, but now I have to give all these disclosures. And we tend to do it in normal speed, in a normal tone of voice, and I know that's not how you're supposed to give your disclaimers and disclosures. You're supposed to speak at extra speed and as much of a monotone as you can, so that's completely unintelligible. But we'll spend the rest of the episode doing that. So for the disclosures, we speak in a normal tone. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program, though it is the name of the radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, that, not coincidentally, is the same firm that I work at. And generally speaking, my father's on the air with me too. Jeff had one of his children get married yesterday. So I was there for that, but I didn't stay the night with other family members so that I could come and be with you on a Saturday morning. So he's usually on the air with me, and he's the other principal at the Personal Wealth Coach and SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Now, what does that mean? Because the firm is registered with the SEC, is not intended to imply in any way that the government somehow has chosen us as their golden child, or any other child for that matter. They tend to look at everyone in a very harsh and skeptical manner, which is what they're supposed to do. They are regulators, and that's their job, to regulate. So just because we're registered with them doesn't mean that they like us. It is something important to tell you, because that's who you should complain to. If I say some really stupid stuff on the... Wait, no, I do that all the time. If I say things that are fraudulent on the air, there, how's that? So, the SEC doesn't give us a thumbs up. Got that one done. The firm gives fiduciary investment advice. That's in the best interest of the client, with all the fees disclosed, really easy to see, all that good stuff. But I can't do that on the air. So this program, even though I have to tell you that the firm is registered as a fiduciary, this can't be fiduciary advice on the air. There's all kinds of privacy concerns. If I'm telling you about your grandmother's social security number, somebody might be affected by that. So this radio program is devoted to educational content. We don't accept money to do this program, nor do we pay for it. So it's not a paid commercial program. Why do we do it then? It's a really good question. I've been doing this program for 24 years. My dad did it 2 years before that on his own. So the two of us have been doing this together for almost a quarter of a century. That's nuts. Why are we doing this? Well, there's some benefit to us as a firm. Obviously, if you listen to us and you determine after wading through all of our speech that you wish to do business with us, you can. Now, I always ask people about their medication level after listening to a program like this and then coming and doing business with us. What are they thinking? But they generally think it's a joke. So, we get a benefit from it, but we don't pay for it. We don't get paid for it. We've been doing this a long time because something that I believe, and I'm positive that my father believes because I'm a result of it, is that the education of our populace needs to improve, particularly in the area of money, because we keep making bad mistakes all day long, every day. And the more we know about it, the more at least we can tell when we've made the bad mistake, even if we still make it. Okay, so now I've said all but one of the disclosures. The last disclosure is that all of the information that we're giving you, or I'm giving you today, come from sources that I deem to be reliable. I am not looking at a backcountry blog sites to get this stuff. As often as possible, we're getting the news directly from the source. If a publication occurs, we tend to dig into where they got their sources. Does it mean it's right? No, we can't guarantee their information. And it's kind of like when we talk about the Chinese economy. They report a number, we go directly to the source, and yep, the number is correct. It is directly from the source in China. Does it mean that's the correct number? Well, we'll probably tell you at the point that we don't trust it in those cases. So those are my long-winded disclosures. We're done with them. So what's happened in the market? Oh, wait, there's a couple more. I'm bald. I have a beard. Sorry. Those are the last two disclosures. Next, what happened this week in the market and in the broader world? We had elections this week. I recognize that if you're listening to this as a podcast or as a program, you're aware of that, because otherwise you would not be listening. You're aware of what's happening around you. This is part of the reason why you listen to this program. It was a surprise to many of the pollsters. Those of you that have been listening to this program for very long know some things that we are not surprised by this. In fact, we fairly well called that it was going to be close to status quo, that there wouldn't be a big blue wave or a big red wave, because we looked at people and recognized that there are big issues on the chopping block right now. And so that causes people to come out and vote. Now, Democrats were just as committed to voting as the Republicans, and so we got kind of a status quo. Usually in the midterm elections of a first-time elected president, you get whatever party, if they're in charge of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they tend to lose the House and the Senate, or just the House. We said it's probably going to be a toss-up in the Senate, and we're probably going to see Republicans take the House. Why did we say that? Because the Supreme Court has been making some decisions that are rather upsetting to the left end of the aisle, and the president has been making decisions that are rather upsetting to the right end of the aisle. That causes people, when they're upset, they tend to vote. Generally speaking, when you see a president who's got the party that they are part of, the party of the first part, is in charge of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, you get hubris on the part of the people that hold that. They're like, we're indestructible, so they don't go and vote. So generally, you see the party switch. We saw that during the Trump administration. We saw it during the Obama administration. We saw it during the Clinton administration. We saw it during the Bush administration. You just go back down through the list, and you just see this regularly. This was a little different because Roe v. Wade in the high court, in the Supreme Court, was a big deal to the Democrats, and inflation's a big deal to the Republicans. We can get into why should that cause people to come to vote when it's likely that inflation wasn't caused by the president and the Supreme Court's not an elected position. And the answer is because we don't often behave the way we think we should or in any kind of logical fashion, but it tends to result with political outcomes. And those of us that study behavior can look at that and say we expect a big turnout from both sides, so expect the status quo. There. You're welcome to still proclaim that I am somehow a genius, but the reality is just look at the issues. Okay, well, some people might consider me a genius, you know, but my mama says I'm very special. And you're welcome to join my special person club if you wish. All right, so what happened this week in the market? We talked about the election. Almost every time you have an election, just about every time in history, doesn't matter who wins, you tend to see a jump up in the market. Yep. I know that's apocryphal. It is heretical. I should be saying whichever party I vote for, if they lose, the market's going to drop. However, when we look at history, we don't see that. We see people are done with the political ads that are talking about how bad everything is and how the only people that can fix it are the people that you have to vote for or the world is going to end immediately. And then the ads stop and people go, ah, or words to that effect. So we saw it this week. The market's up. Our old familiar indicator, the S&P 500, which we get to through the symbol SPX. There are a lot of different versions of the S&P 500. This is the one that we're using. It turned in a stellar week as it worked its way up from recent end of week 3 weeks ago of about 3583. This week, its low point was in Wednesday of 37.48. That's still higher than it was 3 weeks ago. Nice. But then came the Labor Department's CPI report, and traders apparently discovered that the world was not coming to an end after all. And there was a big rally on Thursday morning. It was the largest single-day gain since sometime last year. Yeah, but you've got to have records. So the largest single-point gain since yesterday. Well, in this case, last year. So it's very nice. It's the largest single-point gain of the year, Thursday. And it continued to drive the market up to close the week at 39.92.93. That's up 2.36% for the week. Wednesday's drop, we talked about, you know, I just said that it was down to 37.48 and then got up to 39.92. Well, Wednesday had nothing to do with inflation. It had to do with cryptocurrencies. The collapse of FTX, the crypto exchange, and there's a lot of borrowed money associated with it. And some people put up their stocks as collateral. So there was a big thought in the market that maybe there would be margin calls on that at some point, and those stocks would have to get sold to pay the debts that are owed to FTX. Except FTX declared bankruptcy. They're having trouble. So Friday they declared bankruptcy. They're having trouble getting money together, and they don't really have the ability to make margin calls on stocks. So this was kind of a fear that had more to do with there's a panic going on over there, so let's see if we can make a panic over here. There wasn't. Okay. Then inflation came in lower than expected. Yeah. And that kind of breathed life into the market. So the market has been bipolar this week. It is down still from for the year to date 16.22%, and it's down 14.73% from this time a year ago. At the same time, the index is up 11.46 from its bottom 3 weeks ago, and up 78% from March of 2020, 26% up from 3 years ago. Why do we say all these numbers? We're just throwing numbers out there. Why are we saying it? Because when someone says the market is up, what is their reference point? If you've been in the market for 40 years, the market's up. Even when the market's in the depths of a horrible bear market, the market's up for you, depending on where your measuring point starts. And we get volatility in bear markets. We're getting a lot of it now. And if you're measuring from the very top of the market or the very bottom of the market to show your gains or your losses, it's not really relevant because very few people sold at the top. And very few people bought at the bottom. So as we give these numbers, it's a barometer for a much larger group of people than those of you that are listening. It's likely that if you've been in the market for any length of time beyond 3 years, you're in way into gain at this point, depending on how diversified you are and so on. You can obviously choose a stock that goes bankrupt or put all your money in crypto. That's a different market. Okay, so what happened in the rest of the market? The Treasury bond markets were closed on Veterans Day. It's a bank holiday, but not a market holiday. So the bond week ended at noon on Thursday, which is a little bit weird. The 10-year Treasury note was yielding 3.82. It was above 4% last week. That 5% decline in yield wasn't matched by the two-year note. What does this mean? It means that we have an even more inverted yield curve. And just to give that, usually speaking, when you have a loan you want to get or you want to give, you're either going to get charged or you're going to charge more for the longer the loan. If you want a loan for 30 years, somebody has to lock up money to loan it to you for 30 years, and they would really like to get paid more than if they just locked it up for 6 months or 2 years. So generally speaking, the longer the loan, the higher the interest rate. Well, we're not seeing that now. The two-year loans to the government are paying a higher interest rate than the 10-year loans to the government. So why would you make a 10-year loan to the government? Well, that's part of the deal. Part of the reason why the yield's dropping on those 10-year loans is because everyone else in the world thinks America's a good place to be and they like to buy 10-year bonds. So they're buying the 10-years, and that's causing the interest rate to drop. Why? Well, if you have 12 banks all competing to give you a loan, it's like an auction, and the interest rate gets lower the more they bid. We have a lot of people on the planet trying to buy U.S. Treasuries. So they're buying the 10-year, even though they could get a shorter period, but they're looking around at Europe, at China, at the U.K., heading quickly into recession. Russia already there. Eastern Europe, really, really bad. Where's a good place to put your money? Well, they're dumping it into U.S. Treasuries. And when that happens at the 10-year point, you get interest rates going up. Now, at the 2-year point, people are buying less. The Federal Reserve is dumping a bunch of its 2-year notes into the market right now. And when it does that, it's selling its loan, which means there's less money to loan, which causes interest rates to go up. That's where tech companies and big startups usually get their short-term loans to pay payroll or to buy new equipment. So we're seeing layoffs in the tech sector directly related to this. Okay, so what's the big surprise in the economy? On 11/11, the Labor Department published its monthly first estimate of the Consumer Price Index. And it came in at 8. In September, it was 8.2%. In June, it was 9.1%. These are not good numbers. The expectation was somewhere in the 8% range. But the first pleasant surprise with the 12-month top-line inflation number came in at 7.7%. That's still not a great number, but it's better than 9%. And what's happening in Europe right now is 11%. So when we look at the core inflation numbers, our core number is well below expectations at 6.3%. That's still not good, but it's coming down from what it was. And we should expect to see more of that. I got a lot to talk about on that subject later. But that's going to wrap up the market for now. When I'm looking at, I've got some questions hanging out here. So we'll talk about a lot of this other stuff in the very near future, but I am going to give precedence to our most faithful questioner, Inquisitor John, who, as is tradition, has sent an email to us of a digital picture of the paper version of the Wall Street Journal. So the digital to analog to digital has occurred. It's still alive and well. Don't let it go away. His article that he's sending this time is CFOs ramp up hedges against a stronger dollar. His question is, how do currency hedges work? So, as is tradition, I'm going to answer with history rather than give an easy answer. All right. Hedges are large bushes that separate fields, and they also work well at preventing floods. What does that have to do with finance? Well, if you put a hedge in, it's to prevent your sheep from wandering to another field. It's a fence. And when you're hedging something, you're trying to prevent the values that you know of from becoming values that you don't know of. So what is a good example of this? Back in the mid-1800s, early to mid-1800s, Chicago was one of the centers of trade in grain for the world. It still is, but at a lower amount. Chicago, yeah. Chicago was a booming, relatively new city at a juncture of a bunch of lakes and a bunch of canals, which were the easiest and best ways of transporting things. The railroads had not made big inroads yet. So Chicago's the center of grain trade for the world. And in order to sell your grain, if you're a farmer, in Chicago, you got to get it to Chicago. That's not a minor thing. You have to pay money to get it put on a barge, and then you have to pay the barge and the crew of the barge to get it to Chicago. Then you have to find a buyer for it in Chicago. It was a very chaotic market. The telegraph existed, but it was not in high use yet. There weren't railroads for it to follow. So it was a very short distance communication method. We're still talking about post traveling by wagon or by horse. So when you showed up to market with a barge full of grain, This is how people began the trade. And there were fewer merchants than there were farmers. And for the season, and this is very interesting here, the demand for grain is split across the entirety of the year. But the purchase of grain takes place once a year, right after harvest, sometimes twice a year if the harvests are good. So how do you, if you're a farmer, how do you take that risk of loading up that barge and sending all your grain there? And what if you're a week late? What if all the grain's already been bought that is going to be bought? And that was a problem. A lot of people were dumping grain into the Great Lakes, into Lake Michigan, because it cost too much to take it home. This is not good for grain, because in December, when they need the grain that you just dumped into the lake, it's going to be really expensive, but you don't have it anymore to sell it. So this was a problem. And in 1848, a group of merchants that bought grain got together and said, hey, let's do kind of an auction-type setting where we're all in the same spot. Instead of the farmer has to show up and try to find one of us to buy their grain, let's put it all in one spot and do kind of an auction for it. And so they started that. This was 1840-ish. They started this conglomerate of merchants got together and kind of mutually auctioned it. In 1848, they said, let's do it even better. And we're not really sure who came up with this idea. It was probably off the cuff, but it changed the history of how things are bought and sold for everyone. A blackboard was brought out into the auction, and someone said, I'll buy next year's grain from you at a price, and I'll commit to it. And I'll write it on this board, this blackboard with chalk. And that will mean next year when you come back, it'll still be written there. And that will be our contract, and I'll buy next year's grain from you today. And that's a hedge, because some years, the merchants would go to buy grain and there wasn't enough, so the price would go through the stratosphere. And some years, there was too much, and so the farmers would suffer from it. So the futures market was born, and it was called the Chicago Board of Exchange for the blackboard. Yep, the blackboard is how the commitments for over a year were kept with chalk. And if there wasn't enough room on the blackboard, they got another blackboard. Eventually, they made contracts, individual contracts, but they still posted the prices and the commitments of who it was that was buying and selling in advance, because it was part of the way you made sure that the trade actually took place. And somebody said, I'll give you money today for your crop in a year. I'm going to pay you less than the going rate, maybe, or whatever you negotiate. They might say, I'll pay you today's price next year. So that's how hedging was born. When we're talking about currency hedges, and the article that Inquisitor John sent, the section he's got circled, it says, finance executives at large U.S. companies, including beverage giant Coca-Cola Co. and material science company Dow Inc., are increasing their foreign currency hedges and covering longer periods as the strong dollar continues to take a toll on earnings. What does that even mean? Big companies, Coca-Cola, Dow, are hedging their currencies. Why? Because they're doing business in Europe and in Asia and in South America and in North America, in Canada. And when you make a profit in Canada, but our currency, the dollar-to-dollar exchange rate, Canadian versus American, or United Statesian, that can take all your profit away if the currency shifts strongly. So, for instance, if you're doing business in Europe right now, the euro is running right at parity with the dollar, and it has a tradition of being more like $1.30. So if you made a bunch of profit in euros and then convert them back to dollars, you didn't make any profit. You had a big drop in the value of what you were selling. But if you leave the money in euros, it's the equivalent of not losing that money, but you still have to report it on your earnings statement with the currency shift. So how do you hedge currency? The easiest way to do it is just to buy euros or to buy dollars. Now, that is right now prices. So if the euro is down against the dollar and you think that the dollar is going to fall back to where it was, or the euro is going to rise up to where it was. Buying a bunch of euros with the dollar is a fantastic way of buying the dip in the euro. That's not how most hedging is done, but that is the simplest form. How most hedging is done is relatively complex, but there's this simple way of looking at it. In effect, you're swapping bank accounts, not the control of the bank accounts. But say you have a deposit on a bank in Germany, and a company in Germany has that, and they want to do something in the United States in 7 months. And then there's a company in the United States that wants to do something in Germany in 7 months. They've got dollars. The Germans have euros. And they say, hey, in 7 months, why don't we make this exchange at today's rates or whatever rate they come up with? Let's just say dollar for euro, one for one. Easy enough. You get the rights to all the interest in our bank account, and we get the rights to all the interest in your bank account for 7 months, and then we'll just trade the assets. And that's the most common way of doing a hedge on a currency. Somebody in another place wants to do business where you are, and you want to do business where they are, and you don't want to worry about what the currency might do between now and then, the specific exchange rates between your two countries. So you make a deal to say, hey, at least we'll know if we do it today. Now, there's a potential that you'll make a lot of money by waiting to the last minute and getting it then, but there's also a potential you'll lose a lot of money. And if your business is in selling soft drinks, then you don't want to be into currency risks. You want to be into, let's make money selling soft drinks or bottled water or whatever that is, and you know how to make a profit there. There's a lot of luck that goes into currency exchanges. So that is the easiest answer on how swaps happen for currency. Now, they're usually done in a much more complicated way than a account for account. There's exchange-traded funds that carry the currency at the futures rate that you can buy now. There's a lot of relatively complicated ways to do it, but that simple concept of just an exchange of bank accounts where you're getting interest on the bank account in Germany and they're getting interest on the bank account in the United States. And then you trade the accounts. The actual value in the account gets traded at the end of the period. And I realize it sounds complicated, but the reality is that it's a really decent way to ease trade across borders. When you have merchants that are talking to each other directly, a software company talking to a soft drink company, if you will, and they may have an exchange happening. Now, usually it's so diversified that you don't know who's on the other end of the trade because it's thousands of people and their money's all mixed together into a big pot. But that's a pretty decent example of how currency exchanges actually work, what they really mean. John also says, in this next email, and I believe that there is a lot of tongue in the cheek in this one, buy the dip. My friend's financial advisor, Bernie Madoff, recommends buying crypto on the recent dip. And there's 3 exclamation marks on that one, so it's very emphatic. And I have a lot to talk about on crypto this week. It's fascinating. There are quite a few crypto exchanges out there, which is the opposite of the original white paper on what a cryptocurrency is. An exchange is a centralized place to make a trade. We were just talking about the Chicago Board of Exchange and how they centralized the auction. Instead of going out and finding a merchant on your own, let's have the auction in one spot. And cryptocurrencies originally were peer-to-peer. Everybody's on a network, so anybody can trade with anybody on the network, which is nice. That's a really easy way of moving money around. But the only way to make sure that somebody had it was that everybody's watching everybody else's accounts. And they're encrypting the blocks of those ledger books to make sure that it stays as it was. We know you have money in your account and I have money on my account, and everybody can see that. The problem with that is you got to wait for each block to get encrypted, and sometimes that can take a day, sometimes it can take a week. They're supposed to make the algorithm, which is the silly puzzle that you solve to encrypt a block that has nothing to do with its encryption. And don't get me started on that, man. There's not a lot of logic behind it. It takes a while sometimes to encrypt a block, which means that whatever transaction you're doing may take a while to close. And the idea of a digital currency is that you could move it instantaneously from one place to another. But if it takes a long time to make sure that the block of trades is really secure and nobody can change them, then they don't happen overnight or in the split second. They happen over a week. So some people got together and said, oh, we have a solution to this. We're going to centralize it. You recall that white paper that began cryptocurrency. The whole concept was decentralization, to get it away from governments, to get it away from regulators, to get it away from anybody that didn't have business knowing what you were doing. Well, now exchanges pop up, but exchanges of things that people all agree nobody has business knowing what we're doing. So it's a new form of exchange, even though this is exchanges of financial assets have been around for a long time. This is a new one. So it has to be redefined. And we've had lots and lots and lots of scandals in these exchanges. Mt. Gox back in 2016, if you recall, big hacking scandal where the exchange was hacked and hundreds of millions, now billions of dollars was stolen. And the FBI had a lot of trouble pursuing anyone on it. Why? Well, because it was supposed to be all anonymous, and everybody that was involved wanted it to be anonymous, and they didn't want regulators involved until they had their money stolen from them, or their crypto stolen from them. It wasn't really money yet. So it's a form of exchange and financial transaction. We often have new kinds of financial transactions that come up that lack regulations, and then we have this big enough scandals will cause the government to say, well, we have to regulate that because all of our constituents are complaining about people stealing their money. And these same people are the people that said, we don't want the government to know what's going on. That's why we're buying what we're buying. But as soon as they get stolen from, they really want somebody to get prosecuted for it. You shouldn't steal. That's the conundrum of crypto. I had a conversation about this back in June with you all on the air. I spent a long time talking about how when several big exchanges go down is the point when the U.S. government will start to regulate these exchanges. We've now had two big exchanges go down. The last one, man, massive amount of money at stake here. And I'll kind of go back through this year alone, the issues that we've seen in this crypto crash. So back in February, some game happened. The super something or another, some kind of a bowling event, I think. It's a super bowling. And evidently the ads for this particular sports event are expensive. And four crypto agencies bought big ads: Coinbase, FTX, eToro, and Crypto.com. Now, after that, Coinbase became one of the most downloaded apps on the app markets for both Google and for Apple. Then in April, the SEC announced that it would begin to put regulations on crypto agencies that are setting the stage out there for what is a security. And we went over this on the air with you. If there is a third party that has some kind of control of the outcome of the value of what you're buying or selling, then that's considered a security. So if you buy a gold coin, there's no third party that can change that value. I mean, other people that you buy or sell from can do it. It's just party one, party two. If there's a third party that controls that value, like a company that you're buying ownership in and they lose money or they make money, the SEC considers that is a security and needs to be regulated. I think that makes sense. If you buy somebody's computer and you sell that computer, that's not a security. But if you buy something that someone else says, when we make a profit next year, this will be worth more, that's a security because somebody else has an input in the value. Okay, so that's the rule that the SEC follows. Now, is it a valid rule? Is it? I don't want to get into the ethics or what of it. It's just the rule that they use. The Securities Act of 1933 made it pretty clear what a security is. And so that's the definition that they've come up with to say we're following the Securities Act. So the SEC's now, back in April, saying there's a whole bunch of these that are more related to who's managing a company for the value. Oh, man, got knocked off the air again. Hey, I keep getting knocked off. Do you know what's going on? Was it just now? Okay. Yep, I'm ready. And we keep having drops. So I'm back on the air. The SEC says they're regulating crypto. That caused a lot of issues in the crypto world, a lot of them. The BitMEX became the first crypto agency to announce layoffs. They did 25% of their staff got laid off in May. In April, right after the SEC said we're going to start regulating. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates and stopped buying bonds on the market, started selling them. And I'm back. I guess I'm on the air now. I had been talking before being so rudely interrupted. The SEC started regulating crypto. The SEC started regulating crypto in April. And then at the beginning of April, right after that announcement, you start having layoffs across the crypto world. BitMEX was the first one to lay off. They laid off 25% of their staff. Come forward to May, the Federal Reserve starts raising rates, starts tightening by selling bonds back into the market instead of buying them, which causes less money to be out there. So people start selling assets. We saw it in the stock market and we saw it in the crypto market. Assets started getting sold. So prices start down. Coinbase in May had it's a publicly traded company, was down 80% from their peak in May. And they said if they go bankrupt, people could lose their funds. And then they came back and said, but we're not at risk of bankruptcy. But the reality is that people had thought before that maybe if they went bankrupt, they'd get their money back. But that's just not the way bankruptcy works. So they announced that. Then June, Celsius Network, we talked about this at the time. It's a crypto exchange, a big one, said nobody was allowed to get any money out. Bitcoin went down 15% on the following day. Ethereum came down about the same amount. Layoffs were across the crypto world at that point. Then, still in June, the stablecoin from Tron lost its peg to the dollar. So people were promised that, hey, you put a dollar in, you get a dollar out. Well, it's not true. So Tethercoin wasn't pegged. A stablecoin is not at $1 to $1 now. Still in June, Bitcoin dropped below $20,000. A big crypto lender in June froze withdrawals. That's Babel. CoinFlex then immediately paused withdrawals because they said that there was a counterparty that had liquidity issues. Three Arrows Capital, which is a hedge fund, which isn't, it's a cryptocurrency hedge fund, but it's a hedge fund, said we can't pay our loan to Voyager Digital, another cryptocurrency broker. This is $670 million. FTX announced they'd acquire BlockFi in June. So FTX says, we're going to go out. We've got money. We'll go out and save this other company. You just keep coming down. Three Arrows, which declared bankruptcy then. These are the ones that they defaulted on one of the loans. They declared bankruptcy. Then a whole bunch of companies, Genesis, Blockchain, said, hey, we've got a bunch of loans that we made to Three Arrows, and Three Arrows can't pay. Then the Financial Stability Board, which is it's an international body that monitors different trades, said that crypto must be subject to effective regulation and oversight because of the risks that they pose. So people are starting to call for regulation in a broad way. The Southern New York U.S. Bankruptcy Court Three Arrows gets in there, they say the whereabouts of the founders are unknown. So the people that started this company that has defaulted on now billions of dollars of loans disappeared. So we can just keep on going. It's been a bad, bad year. Celsius Network in July declared bankruptcy. Skybridge Capital in July froze withdrawals. Vald filed for protections against creditors, the equivalency of bankruptcy. We can just keep on going down. Now FTX has declared bankruptcy. They are defunct. What's happening here? What is this? Well, you have a new asset type that we all say, hey, this is worth something because I want to buy it and you want to buy it. So we can use anything that we want as a definition, trading card or a Pokemon or a Teletubby doll or anything, a Cabbage Patch Kid from my childhood. And everybody agrees this is worth a whole bunch of money. And at some point people go, well, I can't really use it for anything. Or I need to get money from it now. And when I took it to market, I got a lot less than I expected, which causes everybody else that's holding the Teletubby doll or the Cabbage Patch Kid to try to go and sell it before they lose everything. And that causes the market to crash. When you have something that doesn't build value, it doesn't create anything, why should you expect to make a profit? And that's a question with a lot of validity to it. If you don't know what value a thing creates and you want to make a profit on it by selling it later, the question is, why should you make a profit? Warren Buffett says this, it's basic common sense. If you buy a gold coin, you can make a profit on a gold coin. A lot of people have made profits selling and buying gold. But why should you make a profit if you haven't changed that gold in any way? You just bought it, and now you're selling it. Now, if you understand the market well, and you think there's a pretty good chance that somebody's going to want to buy it for more than I bought it for, that's kind of like arbitrage. You understand the market. And a lot of people in crypto were like, well, I understand the market. My answer to that is no, the market's only been around for less than a decade. Nobody understands that market. Gold market has been around for thousands of years, and it still has weird fluctuations that nobody can explain. Crypto isn't established enough as a market, and there's always these new cryptos being introduced. So what does it mean? Why are all these bankruptcies occurring? Well, the answer is that a lot of these companies took out big, big loans using their own cryptocurrencies as collateral for the loan. And then when another company comes to them and says, we need a payment from you in dollars for the loan, they don't have it if the collateral has dropped in value. And when we're looking at FTX in their bankruptcy, FTX and about 130 affiliated companies all declared bankruptcy on the same day. Same founders, same owners. Many of those 130 companies were market makers on the exchange that were owned by the same people that owned the exchange. What's a market maker? Well, they're in a traditional exchange. If you're buying peanuts, somebody says, I'll buy peanuts even though I don't have the need for the peanuts, just in case somebody later on wants to buy peanuts. And I don't want peanuts to drop in price so low because there's no buyer. So they're called a market maker. And in most traditional exchanges, all traditional exchanges, the market makers are not allowed to be affiliated with the exchange. They're not allowed to be tied together with their assets to say, like in this case, Alameda is a big market maker on FTX. They're owned by the same people. They're trading the same currency. This looks a lot like Enron when it was making loans to itself and taking the interest on that loan and telling everybody, look how much money we're making. Well, that's happening again, and it's going to happen again in the next thing that comes along, and it'll happen again the next thing after that. This is a tradition in the financial markets to create something, to think it's brilliant, even if it doesn't have value to back it up, to use it as collateral for bank loans because you convinced everyone that it has value, and then not be able to pay the loans back. This happened with the tulip bubble. It happened with railroad bonds in the 1870s, where everybody wanted to sell a railroad bond for every kind of railroad that existed, even if those railroads didn't have any rail cars or tracks that belonged to them, but they were a railroad company. Bitcoin is the most commonly referred to cryptocurrency. It holds its value only in the same way anything else would, if people are willing to pay that value for it. And I think enough people are in a place where they're looking around in Europe, in Asia, in elsewhere, in the United States, big tech companies are laying off. Who are the big purchases of cryptocurrency in the United States? Well, generally tech employees. They have a need for cash because they got laid off. So they're selling assets. And they were the ones that were buying the assets to keep the price up. This is how Madoff failed, by the way. You know, he's paying his Ponzi scheme out. New money comes in. He's paying it as earnings to the people that have been there all along. And everybody's great. You're making this great 12% a year return every year, up or down with the rest of the market. They're making 12% a year. But then the market dropped on everything else. And other people started losing jobs. And so they needed to make some liquidations from this fund. And there wasn't money there to back it up. In essence, it was a run on the bank, and the bank didn't have any reserves. They'd given it out to other people. That's the nature of a Ponzi scheme. In the crypto world, it's not a Ponzi scheme because there's technically a product that people are buying and selling. But once people decide they need money for that product because they need money, there's just not a lot of people out there willing to buy at the crunch point. The market makers are all wrapped up with the currency the crypto exchanges. So you have real problems here. I spent the majority of the hour on this subject. It's fascinating and one of a great deal of risk. But that's about as much time as I have for this hour. Next hour, we can talk about some other stuff. In the process of this hour, I have talked about crypto and about hedging. I want to talk about what we should expect with inflation and a lot of the other things that are much more apparently related to our day-to-day life. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give customized fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management to generally to people of higher net worth. The phone number locally to reach voicemail during the weekend, real live people during the week, we don't have a phone tree, is 254-947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Find our newsletters going back lots of years. Read them, see what we had to say. Sign up for the newsletter now. You can listen to our radio program going back, podcasts, wherever you find them.